This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from New York, from the headquarters of Air America Radio. And boy, tomorrow in Pennsylvania is going to be the primary. I suspect we will be talking about little else tomorrow and Wednesday. It's going to be a fascinating week. This so much is going to be decided, or so little is going to be decided this week. There's a lot at stake. And one of the big issues, frankly, has to do with how alive and well is misogyny and sexism, genderism, whatever, as opposed to racism, or as opposed to, you know, or just independent in and of itself. To what extent are women in the United States not treated as the equal of men? To what extent are they treated in ways, particularly financially, that men would not tolerate? Carrie Lucas is with us. She is the Vice President for Policy and Economics at the Independence Women's Forum. IWF.org is the website. Hey, Carrie, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me on again.
I see your boss, I think. Is it Michelle on MSNBC all the time?
Yeah, Michelle has been on MSNBC quite a bit.
Is it Michelle Bernardi? Am I remembering that right?
Michelle Bernard.
Bernard, that's right, yeah. Well, great. It took me a while to realize that that was the same Independent Women's Forum that you were working with. In any case, you have written this piece. Political experts have just begun to analyze why Senator Hillary Clinton, considered a shoo-in, lags behind Senator Obama. Surely one part of this, and you go through some of these reasons. Equal Pay Day No More is the title of your piece. Last time you and I talked, you suggested that women were being paid the same as men and that sexism really was no longer an issue in the workplace. Do you think that that's the case with Senator Clinton?
I think that Senator Clinton, certainly she's a woman who is out there fighting on her own merits for the highest job of the land. I think that her success is in part evidence of just how far women have come in terms of having opportunities that a few decades ago would have certainly never been open to them. But the real point I was trying to make in this piece is, this week you have the feminist organizations, groups like NOW and some of the old school feminist groups are out there saying that today it is equal pay day, and that women are making 77 cents on the dollar for equal work, and we need to rise up against this. And I think one of the things about that conversation is that it really doesn't ring true for most women anymore. That most women recognize that there may be some lingering strains of sexism out there, and there certainly is some discrimination that comes from sometimes people, men are discriminated against, sometimes women are discriminated against. But this idea that women are systematically paid, three quarters of what men are paid, just doesn't seem to make sense to anyone. And I think that the feminist groups need to kind of get over this and let the facts speak for themselves. And when you look at the real statistics, it simply isn't true that women are paid 77 cents on the dollar for equal work. We really need to get over this kind of tired line of pretending that women are all victims.
Now, your argument for this is that, as I recall, since the last time we talked about this, that women's pay is 77% of men's, but that women spend 77% of as much time in the workplace because they have children. Is that the core of your argument?
Certainly children play a role in it, but it's actually just women and men make different choices about work. So it's not that two, a man and a woman, both go off to the same place of employment, work the same hours, and are getting the same, and women are only paid three quarters what men are. It's women tend to gravitate towards different professions than men. Men take on some of our most dangerous, dirty, and really distasteful jobs.
Which, by and large, are not the most well paid, by the way.
Well, but actually, compared to other things that have lower education, something like being a sanitation worker, being a prison guard, they're relatively well compensated compared to other things that that don't require high levels of education. But the reason, of course, is that it's sometimes dangerous to do things like, you know, be trucking all night or working in a, being a fisherman. These are high-risk jobs. You know, men assume 90-some-odd percent of the deaths that occur in the workplace occur among men. Well, women tend to gravitate towards jobs working with kids, schools, waitressing jobs.
But let's compare apples to apples. The AFL-CIO has links, and you can find it over at their website, AFLCIO.org, back to the census data. And, you know, I mean, this is just, you know, government data. Women lawyers, for example, let's just look at jobs. Women lawyers' median weekly earnings are $206 less than male lawyers. For women in office and administrative support, $71 a week less than men. For women physicians, people who have MDs, median earnings $688 less each week than men with MDs.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that if you looked at other census data, you'll see that the full-time working women, when you compare full-time working women to full-time working men,
that's what I'm doing.
Women tend to spend about a half an hour or less per day in the job than men do. And we all know this doesn't mean that women are lazier than men. I'm not, it's women are making different choices. We're making choices to cut out a little early, or make arrangements with our employers so that we don't have to work as long so we can go home and be with our kids.
But, you know, for women professors, for example, their median pay is $233 a week less. You're saying that the professors teach fewer classes? Elementary school teachers for women, when they're women, they're paid $86 less than men. It doesn't seem to me like these are the kind of jobs where I'll take an extra half hour off is going to have is even possible, or B is going to have anything to do with pay.
Well, remember that a lot of times there are a lot of factors that go into how much you end up getting paid, how many years you spend consecutive in the workforce. Women tend to take time out of the workforce Even those teachers, often it means that the men who are there have been around much longer than the women who are there. We just, and certainly, you know, discrimination can play a role. And there's some interesting, there's also, I think, things that we can really help and educate women about, because there's been studies that have showed that women are much more tentative to negotiate pay. When women are offered our first job, we tend to say, oh gosh, thank you, and accept the salary that we're offered, where men say, okay, but I want $5,000 more. In other words, women are less comfortable talking about money, and we don't value, you know, we haven't been conditioned kind of to value our time as much. There's something we can do about that. I have two little girls, and I need to make sure that during their lives, I encourage them to speak up for themselves and to value their time and to be just as aggressive as men. But we need to, you know, I think one of the problems is so much of the rhetoric around equal pay day is this idea that women are up against this incredible, you know, we're only making three quarters and we should be so mad, and the only way to do this is for government to come in and micromanage things and for us to sue everybody. When in fact, the numbers, even the supporters of equal pay day themselves, groups like the American Association of University Women, when they did a study on the wage gap, they found that these factors, lifestyle choices, the choices women made in occupation, that explained three quarters of the wage gap.
I'm sure this is, you know, one of the variables here, Carrie, and I'm not disagreeing with you on that. And tomorrow is equal pay day, by the way, and so we're sort of a day ahead of this. Like, if my calendar is right,
yeah.
But this larger issue of, you know, you say, you know, you're going to teach your daughters to be just as aggressive as men. I don't think this has anything to do with being aggressive. I think this has to do with we as a society. I mean, there are societies there in Scandinavian countries, for example, in Iceland, for example, women by and large are paid the exact same as men. And in our society, that's not the case. This is a cultural problem. This is something that reaches deep into the roots of our culture and deep into the stories that we tell ourselves about who we are, and goes back in some ways to that old Daniel Boone notion, you know, of, you know, guys, the guy out there is, you know, go out and you know, carve a new life out of the American wilderness kind of thing. And, you know, while the little lady stays at home. And it is appropriate, is it not, for us to be speaking out and saying, hey, wait a minute, that's not a useful model. In fact, that's so not a useful model that not just to the extent that it reduces pay for women, it also disempowers women, which is one of the things that drives up population.
Well, I think that you know, certainly we need to, if there's actual discrimination, if men and women are performing the same jobs and women are just being paid less because of discrimination, then that's absolutely a problem.
Then there should be a legal remedy?
Yeah, sure.
So you've become a liberal, Carrie.
No, you know, but that's what I think, that the thing that frustrates me is that liberals want to make all the choices that women make evidence of discrimination. You know, I don't.
Well, you just said you're in favor of the government getting involved if it can be demonstrated that women are being discriminated against. I guess all we need to do is examine the data.
No, but there's not. But this is on, that's on a case by case basis. What I don't want to have happen is I don't want the government to come in here and say, oh, we have to pay everybody.
But how can you have a case by case basis if you don't have rules and guidelines?
Well, I mean, we need to focus on if individuals can prove that they're being discriminated against. It shouldn't be just looking at the statistics. Because remember, there's a lot of women out there, people like me, who are working from home, who have two little kids, and who feel very fortunate to have been able to negotiate an arrangement with my employer where I'm not being paid as much as I might be if I was in the office every day, but I'm building a life and being able to work and take care of my kids.
And we congratulate you for it. Carrie, IWF.org is the
truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Who's that I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything that a big bad wolf would want.
Listen to me!
Little Red Riding Hood, I don't think even big girls should go walking in these spooky old woods.
See, this is the kind of thing we're talking about. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Program, powered in part by Teamsters for Change. It's time for a change in Washington, D.C. Find out more at Teamster.org. So what's going to be happening with this primary, and to what extent does gender play a role in it? To what extent does gender play a role right across the board in our culture? And here, let me toss a wild card in here. Just got this email from the VoteNader.org folks. Last week, Ralph Nader was polling at 10% in Michigan. Fox News poll a month ago said 14% of voters would seriously consider voting for him. This morning, a Suffolk University poll in Pennsylvania shows Nader at 4%. But here's the, you know, the what's the phrase? The other shoe dropping. Nader's 4% could potentially quadruple, as 17% of Democratic respondents said that if their first choice does not get the Democratic nomination, they may vote for Nader. 17%. See, this is the downside of a long, dragged-out, protracted primary process. And this is one of the reasons I think that Howard Dean is saying, enough already, enough already. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Christy, welcome to this program.
Hey, Tom, I want to tell you that Dee Dee Myers, who was Clinton's press secretary,
right,
has a new book. And in her book, she says that she was paid less than male press secretaries.
That's right.
And less than other men in the administration who had similar responsibilities.
Yeah, she was paid less than the male press secretary who preceded her and less than the one who followed her.
That's exactly right. This goes on. I don't know what that woman was talking about, but this has gone on my entire life. This continues to go on for women in this country.
On the other hand, I'm revealing my age, I suppose. I don't know if you've seen the TV program. I think it's on Showtime, Ad Men, or Mad Men, rather.
Yeah.
And, you know, it takes place in 1960, in the year 1960.
Right.
Now, I was a little kid in 1960, but I remember very well in the late 60s and the early 70s, the first business that I started that was an actual real, you know, business was an electronics repair business back in 69. I was working in radio, and we also had this place called the Electronics Joint, East Lansing, Michigan. And, you know, it was a small business. We had 5 employees. But I remember you'd look in the paper for help wanted, and the sections were help wanted men and help wanted women.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this was 1969. And I think it was that way throughout the mid-70s, as I recall. You know, I remember we started the Woodley Herber Company in 72. And again, I'm pretty sure, in fact, I remember our office manager, The person who was basically a secretary for myself and my partner Terry and for Tom, our bookkeeper, was a guy. His name was Paul, and that was considered very strange at the time, that we would hire a man to do a quote secretary job. But you know, he was very good at what he did. But the point is that, you know, just as little as 20, 25 years ago, literally job descriptions had to do with male or female. I mean, we've really gone a long way from there, but to say that, you know, the job is done, it's like saying racism is over. It's like saying sexism is, I'm sorry, it's not.
No, today when men are employed in jobs like secretarial jobs or administrative assistant jobs, they are generally hired in at more than the woman who worked there previously got.
Yeah, yeah. As is the case with Dee Dee Myers. Now, Christy, I believe that you're absolutely right, and the statistics certainly bear it out. And thank you very much for the call and for checking in with us. Elaine in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Elaine.
Good morning, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to say that the woman that you just had on earlier that was speaking about, she was able to work at home and raise her two children. Good for her. We've all made choices. I am a single parent with a 23-year-old in law school, and I'm a legal secretary, and I'm doing the best I can, and I'm sure that I could be making more money, but it's like you have to do what you have to do to make a living, make the house payment, and all those things. So I think we as human beings all make choices.
But what does that have to do with whether or not women are being paid more or less than men in the workplace?
Well, for myself personally, I don't have a college education. I think in the field that I'm in, I do make good money. Maybe not as much as a man that were in the field that maybe has a college education. But I just think that as women, we do have choices and there are things that we can do. And if I went back to school, maybe I could make more money. I'm just saying.
But should we live in a society where a man is paid more for the exact same work than a woman?
No.
And then what do we need to do about that? I mean, my take on this is that not only no, but that this is part of the larger issue of women having power in not just the workplace, but in society as a whole. As we know, in those cultures and societies where women have relatively equal power with men, population growth slows down and the society becomes less likely to engage in violence. And we've seen this, you can see this going from Native American societies like the Iroquois all the way up to things like the Scandinavians right now. And that's the direction, in my opinion, we need to be moving in the United States.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
It just don't get any better than this. That's about as good ever gets. If there's anything better, it's something I miss.
Well, don't get any better than this, I'll tell you. The Democratic race for president, this from the news wires, as we like to say here, has descended to a level of meanness and acrimony that is damaging to American politics, said the leader of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth. The Swift Boat Group, which became famous in 2004 for attacking Democratic presidential nominee John Kerry, said that they were speaking out because, quote, the current Democratic contest is giving swift boating a bad name, end quote. We have increasingly heard pundits accusing Clinton and Obama of swiftboating each other, said swiftboat veteran Tracy Kloogian. This hurts the reputation of swiftboating. Swiftboating. Mr. Kloogian was quick to draw a distinction between what Senators Clinton and Obama are doing and swiftboating, which he called a noble profession. When you try to destroy a member of another party, that's swiftboating, said Mr. Kloogian. When you do it to a member of your own party, that's cannibalism. He said that the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth would soon be airing ads attacking both Democratic candidates for sullying the reputation of swiftboating. Tear each other up if you want to, but don't take swiftboating down with you, he said. It's just unfair. The Swift Boat Veterans statement came on the heels of a similar statement by the Weather Underground, a 60s radical group that has been tied to both the Obama and Clinton camps over the past week. We denounce and reject both candidates, said the Weather Underground, who has seen its approval ratings plummet in recent days. Elsewhere, CNN's Larry King said he would continue his series on polygamy, saying that he is uniquely qualified to discuss people who have had more than five wives. Yeah, tip of the hat to Andy Borowitz, borowitzreport.com, for these funny takes on the news. Now, here's a take on the news that's not so funny, and then we'll pick up your phone calls, continue picking up your phone calls here at 866-303-2270. And by the way, if you want to drop into our live chat room, TomHartmann.com is the page. Air America is redesigning their web page, but their links to our pages are all screwed up and point to, in many cases, the wrong places. So if you're looking for specific things on our website, rather than trying to find them from the Tom Hartmann page on the AirAmerica.com website, for the moment anyway, just go right to TomHartmann.com, at least until they get it fixed. Food rationing, this is unlike the story that I just read you, or like the one that we did last Friday where we were, you know, where the Russians were saying, oh, that was, you know, the U.S. military versus the U.S. military downing a nuclear bomber in Illinois that was causing those earthquakes. You know, I mean, that was a crazy alert. Obviously, that was not something that we consider credible. But this is an actual real story. I mean, this is from the New York Sun. Today's New York Sun. This is, you know, a relatively conservative local paper here in Manhattan. Dateline Mountain View, California. Josh Gerstein is the reporter, a staff reporter with the Sun. Many parts of America, long considered the breadbasket of the world, are now confronting the once unthinkable phenomena. Get this. This is the United States of America. Food rationing. Major retailers in New York, in areas of New England, and on the West Coast are limiting purchases of flour, rice, and cooking oil as demand outstrips supplies. There are also anecdotal reports that some consumers are hoarding grain stocks. At a Costco warehouse in Mountain View, California yesterday, shoppers grew frustrated and occasionally uttered expletives as they searched in vain for the large sacks of rice that they usually buy. Engineer from Palo Alto, Lajun Liu, said, "Where's the rice? You should be able to buy something like rice. This is ridiculous." The bustling store in the heart of Silicon Valley usually sells four or five varieties of rice to a clientele largely of Asian immigrants, but only about half of Indian-grown basmati rice was left in stock. 20-pound bag was selling for $15.99. And, you know, it goes on. Food rationing in America? Man, this is getting downright spooky. 1-866-303-2270. James, listening on Green 960 in San Francisco. Hey, James, what's up?
Morning. I've been listening with interest. It doesn't take a lot of effort, I think, you know, to find stories about what people call quote-unquote, you know, women's issues. You know, for instance, you were just talking about food right there. So, you know, a lot of NGOs or whatever, you know, various people that are, you know, working in that area, they want to make sure that women get, you know, the resources because they take care of the kids. You know, so, I mean, it's a complicated issue and everything, but I think it's unfortunate that a lot of the rationalization for going to war was, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq was we were going to liberate, you know, the women over there. And,
well, as a matter of fact, in Iraq, the women were doctors and lawyers. They had equal access to the colleges. It was they did not wear, and they didn't, not only did they not wear burqas, they didn't even wear shawls. I forget the name of them. In most cases, Saddam Hussein was, you know, terrible dictator, blah, 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 you know, all the obligatory condemnations. But the reality is that, at least prior to the 91 war, Iraq was one of the most progressive of the dictatorships in the Middle East when it came to being a secular society.
Well, but what if the same sort of rationalization pops up again and going back into Afghanistan where now the Taliban are taking over?
Well, that very much was not the case in Afghanistan with the Taliban, you know.
Exactly. See, I don't think that there should be a rationalization where we pursue these sort of cultural agendas at the point of a, you know, a gun.
I agree. I agree. And the reason why I agree, James, on that is because it doesn't work. You can't beat people into being good people. You can't, you know, pound them down and say, "You will respect women, damn it, whack." You know, you can't do that. I'm sorry. You can't, you know, there's a whole lot of good reasons to take out the Taliban. But, you know, to put that at the front and so, you know, it's a nice, you know, it's going to say a sexy issue that probably a bad choice of words, so, you know, a telegenic issue. It's the kind of issue that our media loves. But no. Chris in Fort Lauderdale, California.
Hey, Tom.
Or Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm sorry. Listen, and Wins.
Hey, I was just wanting to chime in. Let me ask you a question. You were saying rationing. Is it because I know when you were talking a week or so ago, you were mentioning some experiences in the Himalayas, and you were saying Himalayas, and I was like, is there another way of pronouncing it that I'm not getting right?
Yeah, I think Himalaya. So, because I've certainly heard Himalayas a lot, and I don't know if I've heard it in Europe or if I heard it in India or if, you know, but I've heard it both ways. And
maybe the local people call it differently.
I frankly don't, you know, it's been 20, 30 years that I've been traveling to and from that part of the world, and I don't remember where I picked up that pronunciation, but I think that they're both legitimate.
Just a side note, but I wanted to mention, you know, in this conversation about, you know, feminism, well, more or less the sexism that's gone on, or misogyny, and in particular the primary that we're dealing with in the Democrats. And here you're kind of preaching to the choir, because I think progressives, liberals tend to be more open-minded, whether it's race or gender and all that. I know personally for me that's the way it is, and you know, I'm a white male. And right now, there's not a white male as a candidate, and I'm not unhappy about that. I'm actually kind of happy that we have a couple of a new blood, whether it's a woman or a man or you know, a black male. But the thing is, when I hear people saying that they should vote for, you know, because I'm a woman, I'm going to vote for another woman, or even I'm black, I should vote for another black. Barack Obama, I think, epitomizes a success story, somebody who kind of came from nothing and got to where he is, and I think he does. Set a good role model for that type of a person. If I was black, I think I would feel strongly to vote for him, not just because of that, but because of everything else.
Sounds like something out of a Philip K. Dick novel. Blade Runner. to the electric, what do the electric sheep dream of? 9 minutes before the hour. 866-303-2270. Dennis in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Hey, Dennis. Hey, before you get to what you wanted to call about, let me just ask you, what's your sense of how Pennsylvania is moving in regards to tomorrow's election?
Well, I'm actually in the suburbs that they keep talking about, where the where it's basically heavily biased if you look at the as far as the delegates getting awarded.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm actually in Chester County,
right,
which is one of the Philadelphia suburbs. I'm actually fairly close to a town called Coatesville, which is actually a fairly urban population. I've actually done some canvassing there. An example I would give you would be I knocked on 100 doors. I talked to 48. I talked to 51 people, 48 of whom were supporting Obama, 3 supporting Hillary.
Wow. Good on you for canvassing, by the way. Who are you canvassing for?
Obama.
Mm-hmm. And you're finding that there is a broad base of support for him there?
Well, again, I was in an urban area, so,
right.
Again, it's a little, you know, it'd be disingenuous for me to say I don't really deal with the upstate Pennsylvania that I think where the struggle is.
Right.
But that being the case, yeah. I thought that one of the messages that needs to get out, and I haven't heard it on the media at all, whether it be the news or even progressive radio, which, I mean, I spent 3 hours on hold for Alex.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with, you know, hey, why is nobody even mentioning that Michael Moore supported Barack Obama? You know, that I would think that would be, you know, somebody that put all of these liberal issues on the forefront. You know, going back 20 years ago to Roger and me, you know, he was talking about, you know, the deindustrialization of Michigan.
Yeah.
You know, he talked about guns with the Columbine, and he always.
I would think in Michigan this would be a big story, because Michael Moore is, I mean, you know, he grew up in Flint, Michigan, and everybody in Michigan recognizes him as, you know, the local guy. And I'm guessing that in Michigan media it probably got a lot more coverage than it did in national media, whereas Bruce Springsteen, you know, more of a, you know, national rock star kind of thing. That gets a little more play. But when did Michael Moore endorse Barack Obama?
It actually happened. I actually got it via email, and actually it's on his site. I think he blogged on it in the last couple of days.
So it's quite recent?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was on, and, you know, I keep my I keep my eye on a lot of these things, although yesterday I was traveling all day. I didn't know that. Well, thanks for the heads up, Dennis.
Hey, no problem. So, I appreciate it very much.
You're welcome. And the word is now officially out, at least on this program. Let's also go to staying in Pennsylvania here for a minute. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT.
Yeah,
hey, Jim.
Thanks.
You, I'm guessing, have a different view of Mr. Obama than our last Pennsylvanian.
Yes, I'm an independent, although I usually vote for Democrats. And I think Obama, if he won, would be very much like Jimmy Carter.
What does that mean?
In that he would be, he's a nice guy, has a lot of good ideas, but he doesn't have the political savvy to make them happen.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but, you know, 4 months before the election, Carter was way out ahead of a Reagan. If the hostages had not been held in Iran, Carter would have easily beat Reagan. Everybody at the time thought of Reagan as a crackpot cowboy. And it was that one single issue. I mean, people were very, very behind Carter's energy policies. In fact, it's interesting. Reagan, one of Reagan's themes was, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? And the actual fact of the matter is, yes, people were. Wages were up during the Carter administration. And you know, in real wages, yes, there was some pretty bad inflation as the Vietnam War being fought on credit was starting to work its way through. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that people were better off during the Carter administration. And he was very, very popular up until the last 2 or 3 months before the election. And I
agree with you. He was popular in that he was a nice guy and people liked him. And
people liked his policies. They thought he was a good president.
He didn't get through enough legislation. He didn't get enough cooperation.
He got massive amounts of legislation through. He completely transformed this country's energy policies. If Ronald Reagan had not rolled back Jimmy Carter's energy policies and taken the solar collectors off the roof of the White House, we would not today be fighting a war in the Middle East. We would not be importing oil from the Middle East, and 20% of our electricity would be produced by solar energy. He was taking us...
What do you attribute that Reagan's popularity to if he didn't negate all of Carter's good stuff?
I think Reagan's popularity was the consequence of two things. One, he had a very, very large machine that was very good at manipulating the media. You know, Joe Coors, Richard Mellenscafe, all these guys with the Heritage Foundation and whatnot and accuracy in reporting or whatever it was, these guys went out there and played the refs, to use Lee Atwater's phrase, and did it very, very well. And they essentially rewrote history. They rewrote the history of the Carter administration. They rewrote the history of the Reagan administration. Reagan was not all that popular while he was president. Most people thought, you know, he was a little nutty. He was, and there was a serious, very serious recession during Reagan's administration. The other thing that I would say caused people to, you know, think that Reagan was actually a decent president is that he borrowed $3 trillion, spent it, and that stimulated the economy. And the problem is that, you know, we're now paying for it. We're going to pay, you and I, you know, the average taxpayer is going to pay about $1,000 this year in income taxes that is interest on the money that Ronald Reagan borrowed to make things look good during his presidency.
I agree with you that Reagan was one of the worst presidents other than the one we have in there now, who's absolutely the worst. And I am. I'm pushing 70, so I was around. And I, you know, the perceptions were different. I just think they're listening to both of them. Hillary's answers are more complete. They're more politically knowledgeable. I think she knows where the bells and whistles are, and I think she'd make a better president.
Yeah, my position is both of them would make a great president. I am concerned about how she's running her campaign. But, you know, beyond that, I think, and she's a real policy wonk. She knows the issues. She knows the policies. She loves to get into them. She loves to get her hands dirty with this stuff. I think that's great. I also think Barack Obama would make a great president. So I'm just going to leave it at that, and we'll see, let the voters and the superdelegates sort it out. It's interesting times that we live. However, you know, I think that there's some truth to Andy Borowitz's little tongue-in-cheek, you know, they're giving Swift voters a bad name comment.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Call 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman Program. Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And you'll recall we were talking in the last hour about how Ralph Nader may pull as many as 14, 16, 17% of voters, of Democratic voters, are saying right now that if Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama, if their nominee is not the nominee, that they'll vote for Nader. I'm not hearing the same thing on the Republican side quite so loudly, but there are a lot of conservatives out there who are saying, you know, John McCain is not all that conservative, and at least in their point of view, and that they're going to be seriously looking at for example, the Libertarian Party and you know, variations thereof. And so I wanted to get on, you know, a guy who knows about this stuff and who has for whom actually I have a lot of respect, former U.S. Congressman from Georgia, Bob Barr. He's become a Libertarian. Bob Barr, 2008.com, his website, B-A-R-R. And, Bob, welcome to the program.
Tom, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be back with you again.
Thank you. And, yeah, I agree. And I always enjoy our conversations on this program, the debate that we did on NPR, the conversations that we had at the CPAC a year before last. In fact, I was telling my listeners just a week or so ago about how when you were introduced, this was a year ago, CPAC, when you were introduced as the conservative Republican from Georgia who led the impeachment against Bill Clinton, you were applauded. And when John Yoo was introduced as the professor from Berkeley, he was booed. And by the time 15 minutes into the debate, you were defending the Constitution and saying we should not be wiretapping people without warrants, and this is unconstitutional. And he was defending the administration's, what I frankly believe are unconstitutional policies. You were being booed, and he was being applauded, and I thought that was just totally bizarre.
Well, that's actually the precise word that comes to my mind. It's sort of like we had gone through a time warp, and we're in the bizarro world of Superman now, standing up for the Constitution and against government power is somehow to be denigrated and booed. It's a strange political landscape out there, both from the substantive standpoint, where you have things like that happening, as well as from a procedural standpoint, a process standpoint. But the bottom line is, I mean, this is a very unusual political cycle, but one that I think holds great promise. There's a lot of opportunity out there on the Democrat side. Obama's is tapping into it. On the Republican side, Ron Paul tapped into it. And one thing, a number of things that I'm hearing as I travel the country and talk with a lot of folks about whether or not I should throw my hat into the ring after move beyond our exploratory committee phase, is people are just really fed up with government. They're fed up with the hypocrisy of Washington and particularly the Republicans. They're tired of being held hostage to the two-party system. They want a real choice, and they don't see it out there on the horizon right now. And I think this creates a tremendous opportunity.
We're talking with former U.S. Congressman Bob Barr, the former Republican from Georgia. He's become a Libertarian. His website for his exploratory committee, BobBarr2008.com. And Congressman, I believe Barney Frank and I think Ron Paul co-sponsored this piece of legislation recently to decriminalize pot at the federal level. And I know that, you know, every time you get on some of these conservative shows, particularly Hannity, he loves to, you know, well, sir, are you in favor of heroin being available to all our children or not? You know, and that kind of thing. I find it a kind of a bizarre thing, because there are a lot of liberals and progressives who think that libertarians are liberals because they are in favor of federalism. That is to say, they think that the folks like you, and correct me if I'm wrong, think that decisions about things like whether or not pot is legal should be up to either local communities or states and not up to the federal government. And somehow that's perceived as liberal. And yet at the same time, for those same reasons, you think that, or libertarians believe that the federal government has really no business involving itself in issues like education, welfare, housing, whether food is available to people. I mean, you know, even disaster relief, arguably, right across the board, that these are things that should be handled by the states. Do I have this right?
Listen, you got me at the point where I'm ready to vote for you for president.
Yeah, except that I am opposing your positions. So let's have a conversation about it.
I mean, the federal government has gotten so big, so oppressive, so expensive that if we continue down the path charted out for us by the two major parties, there's simply no end in sight, and it will become increasingly difficult, if not virtually impossible, to regain any semblance of freedom such as we used to enjoy in this country and which was envisioned by our founding fathers. A lot of the decisions that the Libertarian Party believes ought to be properly vested in the people themselves, we need to at least begin the process of getting that power out of the hands of the government. Even if we can't return it to the people directly and quickly, at least start the process of moving it down a level to the state level. So, for example, with regard to medicinal marijuana, I mean, at least get that decision back to the people of the state. To the states. With regard to the marriage issue, let's get it out of the hands of the federal bureaucrats in a number of areas and return it to the people of the states. These, and then the people can decide if they, in fact, wish these decisions to be theirs entirely as individuals, whether there are a residual of powers and matters that we want to leave up to the state government. But first and foremost, let's start the process of getting the federal government out of education, out of running our businesses, out of telling us how to run our lives, what sort of light bulb we can put in our lights, how much water the toilet can flush. I mean, it is ridiculous for the federal government to be dictating such things.
But with regard to how much water the toilet can flush or how much what the gas mileage is of automobiles, we have these are issues that transcend states. I mean, you're from Georgia. You certainly know about the water wars that are going on right now between Georgia and Tennessee. And not just Georgia and Tennessee. I mean, you know, it's extending all the way down into Florida now. There are issues that affect all of us. And then you raise the issue of freedom. What is freedom? I mean, how do we define what is freedom? Franklin Roosevelt pointed out that a necessitous man is not a free man. In other words, if you're hungry, you're not free. If you're not sure where your next meal is going to come from, you're not free.
That's nonsense. I mean, that's just sophistry. Whether somebody is hungry or not has absolutely nothing to do with freedom. Whether or not an individual may enjoy the fruits of their labor, of their intellect, that's freedom. And when you have the government coming in and telling you not only how much of your dollar that you earn through the sweat of your brow you can keep, but what you can use it on, that is not freedom.
So you don't acknowledge that there's some basic level of the general welfare. I'm assuming you're familiar with James Madison's arguments in Federalist 41. I mean, basically, half of Federalist 41 is devoted to the phrase, to his arguing about the phrase, the general welfare in the preamble to the Constitution. He's defending the Constitution. And he starts out saying that, you know, some people are opposed to ratifying the Constitution because this general welfare reference is in there, and that's going to lead to unlimited taxation and unlimited growth in the size of the federal government. He says, you know, that ain't going to happen. Well, before the Civil War, that didn't happen. After the Civil War, we changed very much. I mean, our government changed from a strong state, weak federal government to a strong federal government, weak state system. I think in large part because Americans realized if we don't do this, if we don't get all in this together, we are going to keep splitting up and breaking up into a bunch of independent nations.
Well, simply because you mentioned the issue of water, for example, and other resources, simply because something affects more than one state or affects society generally still does not vest in the federal government the power to do something about it under force of law. It's still, even if something is in the general welfare, that still does not mean the federal government can step in, tell you how to do something, take your money in order for it to do something, whether you like it or not.
Why not?
There still has to be an enumerated power. There has to be a specific grant and a legitimate constitutional basis. And I dare say that there is absolutely nothing that can be either explicitly or impliedly found in the Constitution that justifies the government telling me what sort of light bulb I can use in a light in my house.
And I would submit that. And can you stick around over the break and we continue the conversation?
Yeah, we can do a quick segment.
Yeah, and we'll take it to the bottom of the hour. So we got about a 3-4 minute break here, I think, and then we'll have about 5 minutes to talk. And I'll give you my rebuttal when we come back. I'll let you have the last word here on this segment. It's 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program here on Air America Radio. We're talking with Congressman Bob Barr, former U.S. Congressman Bob Barr. BobBarr2008.com is website.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio. Tom Hartman.
Thank you.
Okay, here we are at the OK Corral. Tom Hartman and Bob Barr. Congressman Bob Barr is with us. Considering running for president as a libertarian, BobBarr2008.com, his, what would you call that, exploratory website, Bob?
It is an exploratory committee website, absolutely.
Great. Congressman Bob Barr is with us. You asked the question, where does, in rhetorically, before we went to the break, where does Congress or where does the federal government get the power to do all the things that they're doing? And I would submit to you that the Constitution limits the power of government, that that's its purpose. It doesn't give rights or powers to government. It limits them, that we, you and I, we the people, hold all the rights and powers. And I don't see any place in the Constitution where it specifically says that if the majority of the people, through their franchise, that is by electing the elected officers who do these things, decide that they want to have, for example, a national health care system, or decide that they want to have a higher gas standards because it's going to help the entire nation, or decide that they want to have some sort of a national policy on the cleanliness or availability of water, that it's prohibited.
Well, I guess that we have a fundamentally different view of government. The way I look at government as envisioned by our founding fathers, and I think this is certainly embodied clearly both in terms of principle and in the explicits, that simply because the people decide they want government to do something, excuse me, does not give government the right to do it. And by that I mean, if the people decide they want the government to require everybody in the country to wear a white shirt and red pants and a green jacket, even if 51% of the people vote for that, that doesn't give the government the power, the right to be able to take money from those citizens in order to enforce that ban on any clothing other than that particular style.
Well, I would argue that it does.
A legitimate function of government.
No, I think that would be abuse of government power, and what would happen is that those people who'd made that law would get bounced out of office. I mean, that's the powers in the ballot box. But we do have laws like that. We do have laws like that. If somebody runs down the street totally naked, which would be the opposite of wearing that uniform that you described, they can be arrested. So we do have laws about dress code.
Why is it any different, the government telling you what clothes you can or can't wear? And you say that's an abuse of power. But it's okay for the government to say, well, gee, we think that people are using too much energy, and rather than let the market forces dictate how much energy people need by the charges that are rendered to them and their ability to pay for it, we're going to simply force everybody in the country to use a certain type of toilet or a certain type of light bulb.
Because I think the difference would be that if our elected officials said everybody has to wear a red and green uniform, that they would not get voted back into office, because the majority of the people don't want that. And this is a constitutionally limited, representative Democratic Republic.
If the people decide that anything out there is in the general interest of the general welfare, and they decide this is what they want, that it's okay, so long as the majority of people decide it.
That is my assertion, yeah. And I think, frankly, that's how this country has been run since it was founded.
It's certainly not how it's been run since it was founded. Now, granted, in large measure, it's how it's been run in recent years. For example, before the massive Mississippi Delta flood of 1927, the federal government was not seen as having any legitimate role involved in natural disaster relief. Well, Herbert Hoover, bless his heart, great Republican that he was, decided that it would further his political career as Interior Secretary to go out there and start saying the government needs to do this, that, or the other thing to meet and mitigate the results of this.
Well, that was because it crossed several states. But my point is that libertarians,
government can do it.
If that's the will of the majority of the people, yeah. And that's my point, is that libertarians are picking and choosing. They're saying, okay, in the area of the military, for example, those kinds of powers, we definitely want the federal government to have. But if it has to do with the welfare of the people, no, we don't want the government to have that. And the Constitution doesn't break it out that neatly.
Well, I think that it does, and I think that's the way it was envisioned to be. For example, the basic function of government, according to the libertarian view, and I dare say, according to the view of at least a majority of our founding fathers, was to use government to the minimum extent necessary in order to ensure that people could run their lives as they see fit. It was not, as you're indicating, to enable government to exercise the maximum power that it is able to without the people.
No, please, you're misrepresenting me. I am agreeing with you that they wanted the government to maximize the potential for people to live their lives. And live them without the oppressive power of government.
Government regulation necessary in order to do that.
But I would
have a court system.
Right. But I would add to that that without some certain minimum threshold, you know, back to Roosevelt's necessitous man, without some minimum threshold of quality of life, that you can't have freedom. If our rivers are all polluted with mercury because the federal government isn't stepping in, then we don't have freedom.
Why? But even there, why would the federal? We have a problem here in Georgia. Why do we need the federal government stepping in? Why should not the states be able to take?
Because Georgia would have to go to war with Texas to stop the coal-fired plant in Texas that's producing the mercury that's in the rivers in Georgia.
Not a bad idea.
maybe. Bob Barr, you're a great man, Congressman Bob Barr. BobBarr2008.com. Check it out. Thank you so much for being with us, Congressman.
Thank you, Tom. You take care.
Good talking.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
That's religion. Another new message he was sent to give $1 trillion back to the upper 1%. The rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer.
Tell me that.
How did this country get so bad now? How did this country get so bad? How did this country get so bad now? I want to know.
Well, I gotta tell you, if I were a libertarian, and I'm not, I would seriously consider Bob Barr. Oh, my. Yeah, he was, you know, a little challenged when he was back there prosecuting Clinton, and he was a good Republican for a long time, but there is a certain intellectual purity to the libertarians that I think a lot of us respect, although I continue to refer to libertarians, not to Bob Barr. I don't want to pick on Bob. He's not here to defend himself. But to libertarians in general as Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. Because, that's how you should think of libertarians. They're Republicans, you know, they believe in smaller government. Actually, they're real Republicans. They believe in the government should play no role in anything other than basically having an army and running the police department. Pretty much the bottom line. And, you know, of course, maintaining a court system and a stable currency and stuff like that. And they want to smoke dope and get laid, or at least they want it to be legal, or really what they would want is they want it to be up to the states so that everybody can move to a state where it's legal. So, but where in my mind, where the Libertarian Party breaks down is that it is, or the Libertarian philosophy, let's say, and in particular, those things that spawned the Libertarian philosophy, like objectivism, Ayn Rand's notion, you'll find in her book, Atlas Shrugged, is the idea that it ignores two fundamental aspects of humanity and upon which this country was founded, the liberal enlightenment upon which this country was founded. And that is that, number one, the notion of the commons, that there is this stuff that we all collectively own, like our air and our water and our vote and our federal government. And arguably, I would say that healthcare is part, in my opinion, in my liberal opinion, healthcare is part of the commons. Education is part of the commons. These are the things that we all collectively own, that we all collectively benefit from if they work well, and that we all collectively are harmed if they fall apart. Libertarians would say, no, the commons should be privatized. If there's going to be a road out in front of your house, you shouldn't own it. A private company should own it. Let somebody make some money off it. It'll be more efficient that way. And I just, you know, I ain't going there. The Constitution limits government, but it also empowers the Congress, anyway, the House of Representatives and the Senate, specifically the House of Representatives, to raise money, to define taxes, and to create within the executive branch of government agencies to fulfill the wishes, the laws passed by Congress. So by definition, it's virtually impossible for Congress to create an agency that's unconstitutional. The accountability is not the Constitution. The accountability is you and me. We can vote these bums out of office. We can say enough already. 866-303-2270. Anybody want to call in defense of libertarianism? I'd love to hear from you. Dave, I don't have a city for you, Dave. Where are you calling from?
Oh, I'm Blaine.
Hey, Blaine, what's the state?
Oh, Washington.
Oh, okay, great. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Yeah, you just hit on some of my thoughts. Bob Barr should be the last one to talk about complaining about the government, because the government's not the problem. It's the people that are either appointed or elected, like you were saying, that are either running it or not running it, depending on which lobbyists, you know, they're in bed with. And that's the problem. I mean, our version of government is spiraling down the toilet. We obviously need to elect fearless and honest not leaders but representatives to carry
good
out
save,
the will of people.
Good save.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do.
And
so I
in a perfect world, in a perfect world, states' rights. Yeah, right. But we're not living in a perfect world right now, and so it's easy for Bob Barr or even Ron Paul, for that matter, to, you know, claim to be a libertarian when yet we're in a constitutional crisis, and they'll probably be in denial of that.
Well, I don't think that they're in denial of it. And it's one of the interesting ironies of this is that the libertarians are among those who are speaking out the most, loudly against the abuses of the Bush administration. Dave, thanks for the call. Your point is well made. You know, one of the points that I was going to make to Bob, and the time just got away from us, was that, he said the government can't, if the government said, everybody has to wear a red shirt and blue pants or whatever his example was, they can't pass that law. Well, in fact, they can pass that law. It's just that, as I said, the politicians who passed that law would not survive the next election, and the law would be quickly repealed. But what the Congress cannot do, which is in the Constitution, is they cannot pass a law saying that you don't have habeas corpus rights, that you don't have the right to a trial by jury, that you don't have the right to know what you are being charged with, that you don't have the right to a swift and speedy trial, that you don't have... The Congress cannot strip us of habeas corpus. And yet they did in the Military Commissions Act. They did. And that's where I will agree with anybody. They call themselves a libertarian. They call themselves a liberal. They call themselves a communist. I don't care. Anybody, regardless, I'm right there with you. That is passing an unconstitutional law. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Well, one thing I found with libertarians, not one has had the answer for me on this one, is how does libertarianism prevent problems?
It doesn't. It's reactive.
Yes, and so there are problems like, say, for example, the perchlorate problem or the rocket fuel problem,
right,
in our water supply that you can't get rid of.
Right, and this is a compound that causes cancer in very, very minute quantities, and it's highly hydrophilic. It loves water. It migrates into aquifers and things, and you cannot get it out.
And the libertarian answer is, oh, we can sue them later. But
that's
these
right.
Things are irreversible problems, and libertarianism has no preventive mechanism.
Yeah, well said, Jeff. Yes, it is entirely reactive, not proactive. Because to be proactive would be to add more power to government, right? Jack in Studio City, California. Hey, Jack.
I was just listening, and you were saying something about 51% of the people voted one way, or the Congress voted it, that they can just... the government can come and tell the other 49% what to do.
Yeah, that's the way our government's set up.
The way a republic is not set up that way, is it?
Sure. Yeah, that's let's be honest about what it is. The form of government that we have is constitutionally limited. That is to say, the powers of government are limited by the Constitution. They're not granted by the Constitution. They're limited by the Constitution. We, the people, hold all the power, and we limit the powers that our government can take. Number one, it's constitutionally limited. Representative, you and I don't make laws. Our elected representatives do. Constitutionally limited, representative. Democratic, it's democratic in as much as we vote, and when a majority of people vote for a particular candidate, that candidate becomes our representative. Even if it's only one vote, majority, it's democratic in that context. Republic, And it's a republic in that it's a society of laws that is limited by the Constitution. So we live in a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic. And yes, if our elected representatives, if 51% of them in the House and Senate pass a law and the president signs it into being, no matter how absurd it is, it is the law, and it is, and assuming that it doesn't violate the limits on government placed in the Constitution, it's legal. The question is, would it be practical? And that was where, you know, Bob says, okay, if Congress passed a law saying that everybody has to wear green pants and red shirts, that would be wrong. And it wouldn't be wrong. It just would be stupid. And the result would be that those people would be thrown out of office and the law would be repealed. Because this is a constitutionally limited representative democratic republic, it has its own internal regulatory system. And that's us. We throw the bums out of office when they exceed their own, when they do stupid things.
Well, it seems like a lot of laws are being passed without us getting to vote on them or our representatives.
Yes.
For example, the federal laws about marijuana, when the state said that they wanted it to be legal for medical use,
yep,
and the feds just completely ignored it, even though there was never a vote on it in the first place.
Well, actually, there was back in the 20s and 30s, and there were federal laws passed that regulated marijuana as a result of Harry Anslinger's hysteria, his trying to build the, you know, his narcotics bureau. It was basically a one-man power grab. And so we have these federal laws, and I think that Barney Frank and Ron Paul are spot on in saying, enough already, leave it up to the states. I mean, that's one of those areas where I agree with the libertarians and the old-fashioned Barry Goldwater conservatives. And I think, frankly, most liberals do. I mean, this is American. This is not liberal or conservative, in that regard. I mean, that, you know, with regard to medical marijuana. I mean, it's just pretty straightforward, in my opinion. Patrick in Monterey. Hey, Patrick.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Good. We have a minute before a break. What's up?
Okay. You said that there were two basic principles that libertarianism ignores, and you enumerated what the first one was, the commons, but I don't think you said what the second principle was that libertarianism.
Oh, the second one is that we is family, basically, that we are all in this together. Libertarianism envisions individuals as lone individuals. Libertarianism views us as a nation of Davy Crockett's, when in fact we're a nation of barn builders.
You're talking about the idea of an American family?
Of community.
Community, okay. Great. That was it.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah, sometimes I get off on a tangent here and it just gets ripping, but that's one that really is a core idea upon which this country was founded. And that's why the preamble to the Constitution says what it says. You know, in order to form a more perfect union. Right? I mean, right there, the very first one of the six things that the preamble says we're to do, to form a more perfect union, to create a community, to establish justice, to ensure domestic tranquility, and it's capitalized tranquility, to provide for the common defense. Oddly, defense is not capitalized. To promote the general welfare. Welfare is capitalized. And the reason why is that's how they emphasize words.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
Let's talk about the radio. Sing the only songs you know. You can feel it in your bare soul when you listen to the radio. Lord, my dark side in the sun.
9.5 minutes before the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program here with you. Let me just recommend, just to wrap this conversation up, that you go check out Federalist number 51. Was it 51 or 41? It's 41. I'm sorry. Federalist number 41. James Madison wrote this. The Federalist Papers were written by Madison and Hamilton, and John Jay and George Mason got a little involved in it, but mostly it was Hamilton and Madison. And they wrote them as newspaper articles to sell the Constitution when we were changing from the Articles of Confederation. And they were trying to get all the states, or a majority of the states, three-quarters of the states, to ratify the Constitution in 1789. The Constitution was put forward in 1787, and 2 years later it was ratified. And during these 2 years, they were publishing these things. And in Federalist number 41, Madison asked the question, what does general welfare mean? And you get right to the last paragraph, and he talks about how You know, first of all, the phrase general welfare was also used. Now, I'm massively paraphrasing because Madison's sentences tended to go on forever. But basically that those phrases were used in the Articles of Confederation in multiple places, and that he says people object to this because, quote, they vest in the existing Congress a power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. But then he goes on and he says, you know, this would be ridiculous. He said, but what would have been thought of that assembly if attaching themselves to these general expressions and disregarding the specifics which ascertain and limit their import, they had exercised an unlimited power of providing for the common defense and general welfare. In other words, come on, give me a break. He's basically saying this would be absurd. He says, I appeal to the objectors themselves, people objecting to the Constitution, whether they would in that case have employed the same reasoning in justification of Congress. This is because under the Articles of Confederation, it also said general welfare, as they now make use of against the convention or against the Constitution, how difficult it is for error to escape its own condemnation. So, anyhow, our constitutional lesson for the day. Ellen Ratner on the line with us from Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Sorry for the noise pollution. I'm on my way to Mississippi.
Oh, my. Are you going down to the center that...
Yeah, I am. I'm going to try and finish our swimming pool so we can get it open this summer.
Well, take a minute and just shamelessly plug it and give the website and everything else. Tell our listeners. Not all of our listeners are familiar with what you're doing down there, Ellen.
It's the Past Christian DeLille Community Center, and all the information is on ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com about the center, and we're trying to build really the first swimming pool since the end of segregation in a 30-mile radius where the hurricane first hit landfall. So, and build a community center, and really, you know, a lot of people would not have died if they knew how to swim.
Right, and ThroughTheEyeOfTheStorm.com. It's also the title of a book by Sholene Espinosa, which is a brilliant book.
And well, thank you so much. And you ought to know about writing books because you write the best.
Well, thank you.
Lots going on today. Let's start out with my favorite people, the Supreme Court. They just had 10 people come to them for a halt to their execution, and because of their the issue of
capital punishment.
Not capital punishment, the shot.
Lethal injection. Yeah.
Lethal injection. Thank you very much.
That's
I'm having
right.
a senior moment. And as you know, they decided on the Pope's birthday and his visit to Washington to say that 7 out of 9 of them, that lethal injection was not unconstitutional. So 10 people had cases before them, and they are letting those execution go through. And a good thing that they actually decided, which is a rarity these days, but there was a $112 million award given to one family who had accused ExxonMobil in 1977 of putting radioactive waste on their land. They had won on a lower case. The Supreme Court did not overturn that. In fact, they are not going to hear that case.
Hmm.
Now, you know, part of what I do for you, hopefully, is to connect the dots. And
yes,
one of the things we know is that John McCain despises the U.S. Air Force. Just if he could write, take a pen as president and eliminate them, he would do so.
Is that because he's an old Navy guy and his family is Navy?
I think it's because he's a Navy guy. I don't know why. He just doesn't like them. Well, it turns out that Senator McCain today is in Alabama for his Time for Action tour. Well, at the same very time, the administration has Secretary Robert Gates giving a speech at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama today, and he said that the Air Force, to get them to do enough in Afghanistan, in Iraq, he said this at the Air Force Base, is like pulling teeth, and it's not good enough what they're doing. So I'm just saying, interesting. McCain hates the Air Force. Somehow, the Secretary of the Defense Department is in Alabama the same time John McCain is giving a speech about the Air Force.
Interesting.
So we're going to see more on that.
How would that play out if he were president, his dislike of the
Air
Force?
Well, I think we'd see the resources to the Air Force dry up pretty quickly.
Oh, interesting. And all the pilots would become pilots operating off carrier decks.
Exactly. You got it. I would think that that the Navy would. My guess is he would find some way to restructure it.
Mm-hmm. Or put the Air Force under the Navy.
Something. Yeah. Exactly.
I mean, it used to be part of the Army. It used to be the Army Air Force.
Exactly. We wonder what would happen to the Air Force Academy. Meanwhile, a lot of Mideast news today. King Abdullah of Jordan is going to be visiting the White House on Wednesday. On Thursday, Prime Minister Abbas from a Palestinian Authority is there. Condoleezza Rice said that the Arab countries are stepping up more in Iraq. And President Carter, as you know, met with Hamas. He said that Hamas is willing to go back to 1967 borders for a Palestinian state, but peace is not likely. However, the State Department's Tom Casey said there is no change in Hamas's position.
So Hamas told Carter that they were willing to change their position, and the State Department says no, they're not? Is that
That's
what
right.
I just heard?
That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's a very interesting contradiction. Interesting.
Not surprising, though.
Yeah, I guess not. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
As always, for a great summary of the news. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Where smart people get their news.
So some guy wrote an endorsement for the book whose editor is coming up here in just a second. He said, heading into another presidential race, we the people have to face the fact that our election system is a shambles, run by private corporations with a partisan agenda and largely based on a technology that anyone can rig. This great book will tell you all about it and, even more important, help us overcome it. Mark Crispin Miller is the editor of the new book, Loser Take All. His previous books, Fooled Again, How the Right Stole the 2004 Election and Why They'll Steal the Next One, too. The Bush Dyslexicon, one of my absolute all-time favorites. It really opened my eyes to George Bush, one of the early ones that really, for me, was just a huge forehead slap. And Cruel and Unusual, Bush and Cheney's New World Order. Mark Crispin Miller, professor at New York University, right, Mark?
That's right.
Yeah. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on, Tom. It's good to talk to you again.
It's always great talking with you, Mark. And this strange guy who made that blurb for your book, that was me, right?
That was you indeed.
That was me.
Tom the Golden-Tongued.
Yeah, well, you know, you have compiled a brilliant collection of essays, writings, documentaries, I don't know what the right word is, delineating both how in the past our elections have been stolen and how in the future they may well be. You know, yesterday, Mark, I was watching a BBC coverage of what's going on in Zimbabwe, and I'm sure you're familiar with this, and probably most Americans are not. But a few weeks ago in Zimbabwe, there was an election.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear that the opposition won the election. All the polls showed that. Everybody agreed on that, by and large. The news media certainly agreed on it. The United Nations agreed on it. Even Robert Mugabe, the guy in power, all but acknowledged that. But he has not allowed there to be a count of the or to a release of the ballots. And I'm watching this, and the whole world is shocked and horrified by the fact that Mugabe won't allow the count to be made public. And suddenly it occurred to me, we never, you know, our federal government never made public the count in Florida.
That's right. Well, there was a recount ultimately, as you know, by the media consortium that was deputized to do just that. This is the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, CBS News, etc. They counted the votes. That is to say, they counted all the ballots that were there to count in Florida after the 2000 election. And what happened is instructive. In effect, pretty much the same thing that the government did, which the government simply has clammed up about it. The media consortium discovered, and this will come as news, I'm afraid, to most of your listeners, that Al Gore won the popular vote in Florida.
Yeah, well, actually, hopefully it doesn't come as news to most of my listeners, because I try to talk about it at least every other week. But I think it will come as news to most Americans.
It'll, exactly.
That this was a coup. The election, the so-called election of 2000 was a coup d'etat executed by the Supreme Court, and at least three of those members of the Supreme Court who voted that to quote Bush v. Gore, the plaintiff, George W. Bush, would be irreparably harmed,
yeah, irreparably
if
harmed.
If the count were to allow to be continued in Florida.
Yeah.
It's absolutely mind-boggling, and that three of those members of the Supreme Court had relatives, direct relatives, who were working on the Bush campaign. They should have recused themselves.
Absolutely. Vincent Bugliosi wrote that great book about that decision in which he actually said with a straight face, and I agreed with him, that those five members of the Supreme Court should have been prosecuted.
There were five of them.
Five in all, yeah. Three had actual family members, as you know. But the thing is that there's a couple of essays in Lose or Take All about Florida in 2000.
Right.
One by Lance DeHaven Smith lays out the various ways in which the Republicans stole thousands and thousands of votes from Gore by Election Day,
right,
and then continuing on into Election Night.
Right. Yeah. What we're talking about is that Gore won even with 80,000-90,000 people African Americans disenfranchised because their names were similar to felons in Texas, et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. He won anyway. He won despite the obstacles.
Right.
Among other things, the argument that Ralph Nader stole the election from Al Gore is based on a fantasy.
Right.
He didn't lose.
How is it, by the way, that Barack Obama, in the debate the other night, said, you know, when they asked him about Al Gore, and he said, and by the way, I believe Al Gore won the election in 2000.
Yeah, that was...
Why was that not a screaming headline?
Well, for the very reason that the same media outlets that actually counted those ballots, and then reported the news... It was actually 2 months after 9/11 that the results of that recount were ready.
Right.
The very news organizations that counted those ballots then reported the results of their own count by spinning it as a Bush victory.
Right. They buried the actual statistic in the 17th paragraph.
If all the votes in Florida had been counted, and that's how we judge election results, is by counting all the votes, Gore was actually the one who was supposed to be president. I am told that the people, who made these decisions felt in their sort of paternalistic way that since we were at war now, it would have been a disservice to the nation to tell people the truth about the fact that the wrong guy was in the Oval Office.
Right.
Well, I think, one...
Well, didn't Hal Raines as much as say that?
Yeah, he did.
The editor or the publisher of the New York Times?
Right, exactly. And others at the Washington Post have said it privately. But this, this explains why Obama's, startling and refreshing statement about Gore's victory did not get covered. Once the media invested itself in a lie, which they did then, by my misreporting the results of their own count, they have never been able to go back and talk about what happened then honestly. And the consequences here, I think, are, and this is what Loser Take All tries to do. It tries to demonstrate that what happened in 2000 was not an anomaly. It was not an aberration. It was not a one-off. It was the beginning of a long, comprehensive, concerted drive against democracy that affected the congressional races in 2002 and other races then, such as Don Siegelman's reelection bid in Alabama. It resulted in the theft of John Kerry's victory in 2004 in Ohio and elsewhere,
yep.
and even in 2006, which many Democrats point to somehow as evidence that the election system is sound because they won 29 seats, as one great essay in Loser Take All demonstrates by Jonathan Simon and Bruce O'Dell. The Democrats seem to have won more like 50 House seats in that election.
Right.
The Republicans did commit demonstrable election fraud, primarily using the machines in 2006, but they couldn't give themselves enough of a boost to overcome the impact of all those late-breaking scandals like Foleygate and so on.
Right.
So, what should have been an absolute rout against the Republicans turned out to be merely what what Bush called a thumping in his colorful
right.
way.
We're talking with Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media culture and communications at NYU. His new book is called Loser Take All. Mark, we just have a minute or so here. What should people expect and what should people do right now as we
all
come
right,
into this election
season? First of all, a very high turnout is crucial. So people have to turn out, and they have to monitor.
So if they're going to steal 5 million votes, we need to turn out 7 million.
Exactly. Or 10, you know.
Yeah.
People have to monitor the elections wherever they live very, very carefully. But the most important thing, Tom, is that people have to be psychologically prepared for this regime to steal it yet again. If they can make this race look at all close, they will be in a very good position to steal this, even for a candidate as hapless and uninspiring as McCain. And there are three or four essays in Loser Take All that report all the things that this regime has been doing right along the last few years to ensure a bogus victory for the Republicans. People have to be psychologically prepared for this, because if they go to all the trouble to vote this time, and naively expect, you know, their choice to prevail, and then it's taken away, as happened in 2004. The worst thing that could happen would be for people to simply cave,
right,
to keel over.
Or to swallow the narrative that, well, the country just wasn't ready for a black man or a woman.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The rationale,
and that's going to be the narrative.
The rationale for the next startling victory is really the most important thing, and people have to be ready to say no to it.
Yeah, there you go. Mark Crispin, Miller.blogspot.com, your website, the new book, Loser Takes All. Get this book. Go to your local bookstore, pick up a copy, buy it online, whatever it takes. Loser Takes All. Mark Crispin Miller is the editor. Thanks, Mark, for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. Take it easy.
Thank you. 16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Some people care about what other people think, worry about what they say. Little gossip coming from a loose lip will ruin my perfect day.
Let's check in with Thea Lee for our weekly labor segment. Find out what's going on in the world of labor. She's the policy director at the AFL-CIO. Their website, AFLCIO.org. Thea, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You know, there was a time in the United States back in the 1880s, Joan Baez's classic song, Joe Hill. I mean, she wasn't the first to sing it, but, you know, that song and others, the Pullman Porter's strike, the Haymarket Square riots. The whole history of the Wobblies, prior to the Reagan administration, when they started changing our textbooks in our high schools, most generations of Americans actually studied the horrific experiences that people had as they were trying to organize labor in the United States, particularly in the 19th century and early 20th century, as labor leaders were executed, as their houses were burned and their children died in many cases. As they were, police departments came in and opened fire on them, as private police departments were created specifically for the purpose of busting unions. I believe Pinkerton, their primary purpose initially was not to be a private detective agency, but to bust up unions. And those of us who, you know, studied that era and know it well, and those Americans who may have some passing familiarity with it, I suspect think that, oh, those days are long gone. Well, certainly to some extent they're long gone in the United States, but ain't so in Colombia.
That's exactly right. And many other places, unfortunately, around the world where being a member of a union, and particularly a union that's involved in a conflict, a struggle, a strike, or criticizing the government, can really put a person at risk of their life, and some of these folks, it's hard for us to imagine here in the United States. We face a lot of struggles in the labor movement trying to organize and bargain collectively and build our movement and fight for good laws, but most of us don't fear for our lives as we do that work.
Yeah, John Sweeney has written this brilliant piece, Colombia, No Rights, No Trade. He starts out with the 16-year-old Andres Damian Flores Rodriguez on his way home from school. He's forced into a van. They call his father, a labor leader. He says that he's going to be quartered. That's like literally, you know, they tear your body in four pieces. Adolfo Gonzalez Montes, a member of the Barrancas local union of coal miners, found dead in his house, tortured and then finally shot after his union received death threats during a union conflict. March 9th, Carlos Bourbano, vice president of the National Hospital Workers Union in Colombia, murdered in San Vicente del I'm not sure how to pronounce that, after leading a local peace march. I mean, they found his corpse in the city dump, his face disfigured with acid. This is the state of labor relations in Colombia, and George Bush wants to go down there and say, everything's fine, let's have a deal.
The stories break your heart, and there's stories of violence and intimidation and threat of, you know, we have some of these, the death threats that the paramilitary groups have sent out to the workers, and they send chills down my spine, and I don't live in Colombia, but, you know, it's just hard to imagine if thousands and thousands of your fellow trade unionists had been killed over the last couple of decades and very few people had been put in jail for it.
To the contrary. In fact, the government calls these trade unionists terrorists.
Well, and that's exactly the problem, is that President Uribe has come to the U.S. Congress, and they brought a lot of delegations of members of Congress down to Colombia, and he makes this very impassioned pitch, and I've heard it a couple of times. You know, he seems very sincere. Oh, I love trade unions. I love human rights. I love democracy. My whole administration is geared toward protecting trade unionists. But you contrast that with the stories we heard. I was in Bogota with a union delegation in February this year from dozens and dozens and dozens of trade unionists who say that the Uribe government has not only not helped them, but key top members of the Uribe government have actually targeted trade unionists and human rights activists, calling them guerrillas. And when you do that in Colombia, it's like you paint a bullseye on somebody's forehead. And in fact, just a couple of weeks after this, senior Uribe advisor said that the organizers of this peace march were associated with the FARC, the guerrilla movement, four of the trade unionists were murdered in 1 week.
Right. The last time I was in Colombia, I actually wrote about it in one of my books, a book called The Prophet's Way. What we saw is that this was happening to trade unionists. This was also happening to people who were simply trying to work among the poor, in part out of fear that they may start unionizing them. I met a woman who had been disappeared. You know, she had been basically taken for ransom and tortured and raped, and finally her husband, you know, totally wiped out, gave it back, and they were able to track this back to people involved with the government.
Well, and the really sad part, or I don't know whether it's sad or tragic comic, you know, that we've been complaining and we've been raising this issue about the murders of trade unionists and the impunity for many, many years now. We've been in conversation with our government, the Colombian government. And one of the answers we're getting now from folks is, gee, everybody in Colombia gets murdered. It's not just trade unionists, it's judges, journalists, and community activists. And I always think, well, that's an odd thing to say in favor of this free trade agreement,
right?
That there's widespread political murder.
Yeah, so let's just empower them.
Right.
Amazing. Thea Lee, the policy director of the AFL-CIO, the website AFLCIO.org. Great new article there by John Sweeney as well. Thea, thanks for dropping by.
Thanks for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I think we need a gunslinger, somebody tough to tame this town. Think we need a gunslinger, there'll be justice all around. I think we need a gunslinger.
Yeah, let's bring in somebody who's not beholden to the machine. What a notion. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, our live chat room, AirAmerica.com, although let me warn you, most of the links on the Tom Hartman page over at the AirAmerica.com website point to spots on our website that are dead or no longer exist, so until we get that fixed, check out TomHartman.com first. Dwayne in Sonoma County, California, speaking of we need a gunslinger, you want Ralph Nader?
Well, great program today. I really enjoyed your guest talking about Gore's stolen election and clarifying the Nader issue, and then followed up by this talk about what they're doing in Colombia on these unconstitutional free trade agreements. But the reason I call is I would vote for anyone except Clinton, and I'd like to tell you why.
Sure.
I have a child who has an extreme food allergy and life-threatening. And throughout the first Clinton administration, he was pushing and allowing the bovine growth hormone. One of my neighbors get threatened from the agricultural department if they label their food, their milk, that they would get hauled into court.
Well, it wasn't just your neighbor. I lived in Vermont. Ben and Jerry's got threatened. They put on their label BVG or whatever, RGBH free, and the Department of Agriculture, at the behest of, I believe it was Monsanto, came in and said, no, you can't say that because that will raise doubts in people's minds about other products.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, that was the goal, you idiots.
And the organic, they attempt to modify that and adopt a federal standard and nullify my state standard,
yep,
and allow sludge and even genetically modified foods to be put
called
out as organic.
Yep.
It, at each and every point, when Hillary was trying to do her medical, what I characterize as to establish a new medical industrial complex, the attitude is one that threatens the very health of my child, and I just will vote for anybody. I'm including one of your earlier guests, the
Bob Barr.
I'll vote for anybody rather than Clinton. I just cannot, in good conscience, look my child in the eye and say I voted for another Clinton.
Yeah, this is the tragedy: is that there are so many people who, you know, I get so many emails that say something similar to that. And yet at the same time, you know, I'm getting all kinds of email, mostly from, I guess, Republicans or relatives of them, you know, with all these wild conspiracy theories about how Barack Obama is secretly a Muslim and his, you know, his uncle is Osama bin Laden and blah, blah. I mean, you know, it just goes on and on, or, you know, won't put his hand over his heart, or William Ayers is, you know, he and William Ayers are conspiring to blow up the federal building. I mean, it is bizarre. It is absolutely bizarre. The ferocity. I am, you know, the thing that concerns me, Duane, is I know some really strong Obama supporters and some really strong Clinton supporters, just as personal friends and colleagues. And most of the Obama supporters I know feel that, you know, he's the best candidate, and they're pushing a positive message about him. Occasionally, though, I hear this vitriol against Clinton that, frankly, scares me, because if you don't vote for her, if she's the nominee, you're going to have John McCain. I also hear vitriol from some of the Clinton supporters and a few of the Clinton and a few of the progressive websites that is so not pro-Obama but anti-Clinton that I think it's going to cause a lot of people to adopt your worldview that they would vote for anybody other than Hillary Clinton, which, again, is going to cause us to have John McCain. I mean, what about the concept of if she's the nominee and if she's the president, we have to hold her accountable. We need to be pushing her in a more progressive direction.
I'm afraid from the attitude towards our occupation that I'd be demonstrating in 3 years to impeach her if she was elected for just carrying on the war. It's the same situation with Lyndon Johnson. Basically feeling he couldn't pull out of Vietnam. I think we'll find the Democrats.
Well, that wasn't Johnson's decision, though. I mean, that wasn't Johnson's decision. That was, I believe it was Tip O'Neill and a couple of members of Congress walked into his office and said, you know, Mr. President, you are not going to run for another term. This party is pulling the plug on you.
Right, but before that, when you'd have people like Nixon with a secret plan to win.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll find the Democratic Party in this as being the war party in another 2 years.
Yeah. Well, we'll see. We'll see. You know, I think it's increasingly apparent to most people that in all probability Barack Obama is going to be the nominee. But even if Hillary Clinton is the nominee, my take on it is that we need to be diminishing the attacks on both Hillary Clinton and on Barack Obama and elevating. I was going to say elevating the attacks, but I'd rather do it in a little more dignified way. Let's more clearly define John McCain. You know, I think that's really the direction we need to go. Kirsten in Aberdeen. Hey, Kirsten, what's up?
Shalom to you, Tom.
Well, thank you.
Mark Crispin Miller's comment that we should psychologically prepare ourselves in the event that this election is thrown as well. I'd like your input about that. I know that you must have some. It was a rather, I thought, cryptic remark, and so I need help, as do others, I'm sure, to understand. And secondly, Senator Chaffee's new book, the title of which escapes me now, Senior Moment, in which he outlines a luncheon that he and several other key congressionals shared with Cheney directly after the announcement that our President Bush had made it into office, in which he stated categorically to all of these men gathered at the luncheon table that this was to be a unitary government.
Right. Well, and then
shocking. And then
here's another weird one. Congressman Peter King, the Republican from New York State, was caught on videotape, and I'm here in New York in the studio. I don't have my computer with me, so I can't play you the clip to it, but I've got it. Congressman Peter King was being filmed by Nancy Pelosi's daughter, and you know, for this little kind of mini documentary. And he was drunk, and it was the day of the election, the 2004 election, the John Kerry election. And he said, and this is damn close to verbatim. I'm doing this from memory, but I think this is verbatim. He said, "It's all over. The election's all over. We won." And she said, "What?" Because, you know, people were still voting. And he said, "It's all over but the counting, and we'll take care of that."
Lord.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyhow, as to what Mark meant, I would encourage you to go to markcrispinmiller.blogspot.com and directly ask him. I can tell you that, you know, from what I know, that there are folks with activists within the progressive movement, even way beyond the Democratic Party, who are debating right now what sort of action should be taken if the election is stolen like it was in 2004 and 2000. And there's enough evidence, as there was in both those elections, to build a case. You know, should we be out in the streets? Should we be trying to take over media outlets? How do we speak out in a way that actually has credibility, that doesn't cause people to say, "Oh, those conspiracy nuts, there they go again," and actually energizes the average person? And it's a very, very delicate, you know, balancing act. But I think that a certain amount of rage and outspokenness is absolutely necessary. That is, frankly, you know, I mean, Al Gore took this thing as far as it could go. As he said, you know, after the Supreme Court had ruled, the only next thing that could be done is armed revolution. And so, I mean, I give him credit. He fought it for months, and every single day, 24 hours a day, there was this group of conservatives who were surrounding the Naval Observatory Building, which is the vice president's residence, shouting with bullhorns, "Get out of Dick Cheney's house," 24-7. His children were terrified. I mean, Al Gore's children were terrified. They were locked down. They were trapped in there by these cons who were shouting, "Get out of Dick Cheney's house." As the counting was going on, as the counting was held up, you had all these cons, all these guys out of Tom DeLay's office going down there, banging on the windows, looking, trying to pretend that they were Floridians when actually they'd come from Washington, D.C. I mean, that election was stolen, pure and simple, you know, period, end of sentence. And in my opinion, the 2004 election was stolen in Ohio as well. And what are we going to do if another election is stolen? Kirsten, thank you for the call. I don't know the answer right now, but I do know it's a conversation we need to be having. Jackie in Houston, Texas. Hey, Jackie, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Listen, from the very first hour, the things that have occurred to me are what was going on are some of the things that Ryan Eisler has talked about a partnership society, and that we have really lost it. And she talks about how there were matriarchal societies, a lot of evidence for this,
yes.
And then there were partnership societies, and then what changed was when the development of the metallic weapon and societies became male-dominated to the exclusion of women, and that's where war started and how war societies have so failed. And I think this is where people are right now. They really see that Barack Obama has maybe a vision to more of a cooperative society that isn't
for based on Warren.
Even though he's not a woman.
Perception. Yeah.
Yeah, even though he's a man. Yeah, and Rhianne Eisler, she's a dear friend. Her and her husband David Loy. In fact, last time I was out in Monterey, we had lunch at their home, mm-hmm. and she introduced me when KRXA put on a gig there, and I spoke, and
uh-huh.
Rhianne is just absolutely wonderful, and I strongly recommend people read her book on The Partnership Way, I think is the title, and
yeah,
her
and
previous books,
The Chalice
and the Blade, right, which Dan Quinn credited as being his inspiration for the Ishmael books. And I think you're right that Barack Obama is articulating a vision of this world and of the future that is not inconsistent with that of Rhianne Eisler. And hopefully Hillary Clinton could or would. Any Democrat is going to be a whole lot closer to that than John McCain, whose life was defined by war and continues to be defined by war. 45 minutes past the hour.
Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Do you know what your face is? Now you're trying to shake it. You're doing your best and your best love. You're praying that you make it.
You know, I think one of the most important stories probably so far this year was broken by the New York Times yesterday. By David Barstow. The headline was "Behind TV Analysts, Pentagon's Hidden Hand." It was a front page story in the Sunday's New York Times. And basically what it laid out is that all these retired generals and admirals and colonels and lieutenant colonels and everything else that you see on TV, almost without exception, as far as I can tell from reading this article, and I have read it fairly thoroughly, if there were exceptions, they didn't highlight very many of them, one or two, but almost without exception, when you see these guys on TV, they are, not only are they getting paid somewhere between $500 and $1,000 a pop to be on TV, which is not uncommon for people. You know, when somebody says, an MSNBC analyst, you know, if they've got the title that associates them with the network, that means that they are paid every time they're on TV. Every time you see Pat Buchanan on TV, ding, he gets another $1,000 in his checking account, for example. So, number one, they're being paid by the network. But even more insidious than that, or arguably that's not even so insidious, the insidious part of it is that they have, is a two-part thing. One, that they have been targeted for manipulation by the Pentagon, and they have been heavily subjected to manipulation, to the point that one of them made a joke about, you know, the George Romney tour. George Romney, Mitt Romney's father, the guy who was, when I was a kid, was the governor of Michigan, went over to Vietnam and came back and said they tried to brainwash me, or said he had been a supporter of the Vietnam War. When he came back, he was opposed to it, and he said I was brainwashed. Now, it was political death for him to say that, but you know, these guys, they're talking about this brainwashing programs. The man on the plane, they're talking about a group of people that they took down to Guantanamo. The men on the plane and several dozen other military analysts represent more than 150 military contractors, either as lobbyists, senior executives, board members, or consultants. Now, when you see a general on TV or when you see a retired military official on TV talking about the war, particularly if they're talking in favor of the war or if they're echoing administration talking points, they have stock in one of the defense companies. In all probability, they are a lobbyist for one of the defense companies. They're receiving funds from one of the defense companies. And they are being groomed and massaged very, very carefully by the Pentagon, by the Department of Defense, and by the Bush administration, including things like private meetings with Dick Cheney and private meetings with George Bush, and on it goes, to echo the administration's talking points. In fact, in this article in yesterday's New York Times, and you've got to read this, Behind TV Analysts, Pentagon's Hidden Hand, they talk about how even in the run-up to the war in 2002, that there were a lot of these retired officers who were looking at the evidence and going, this is nonsense. But we're not saying that on the air because their economic interests were at stake. Their careers, their future careers, the money that they were going to add to their military pension was at stake. This is beyond criminal. This is beyond immoral. This is a spitting in the eye of a slap in the face of democracy itself. These men who are being held up as patriots and heroes, it turns out, are liars and cheats, are turning their back on democracy itself, are selling us out for a mess of pottage. They are absolutely, I lack metaphors that I can say on the radio. What they are doing to this country. And what they have done to this country over the last 7 years. And the networks who are complicit in it and going along with it. It is just so very wrong. 1-866-303-2270. We've talked about an awful lot of stuff today here. Many different areas. Kurt in Los Angeles, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Kurt, what's on your mind?
Hey, I'm just curious. I was listening when the statement was made that those five Supreme Court justices should be prosecuted.
Yep.
Why are they not prosecuted?
Because there is no mechanism for prosecution while they're in office. The mechanism is impeachment. They could be impeached, but it would require a majority of the House of Representatives and a two-thirds or 60%, I believe it's two-thirds of the Senate. I mean, the impeachment process for a sitting member of the United States Supreme Court is identical to that for president.
And what about, so we can't prosecute Bush either. We have to wait until he's out of office to do so?
Now, I'm not a constitutional lawyer or scholar, at that level, but that's my understanding, if not by... It doesn't say that in the Constitution, but my understanding is that that's pretty much how the law is. Yeah, that you.
And that leads me to my next.
Hang on just a second, Kurt. I'm wrong, because they were actually prosecuting Richard Nixon, and in the Nixon versus the United States case that went to the Supreme Court ruled that Congress could subpoena documents from the president, and the president had to produce those documents if it involved a criminal case, if it involved a crime. So, yes, they could be prosecuted.
And that leads me to, where are all the constitutional lawyers, and why are they not on the front lines with you and the other liberal media?
A lot of them are speaking out. Marjorie Cohn is one of my absolute favorites. Her website is Marjorie Cohn, cohn.com, as I recall. Certainly you can Google her name for her website. She's written a book about the crimes of the Bush administration. And she's the president of the National Lawyers Guild, the second largest organization of lawyers in the United States, I believe, behind the ABA. And she is outspokenly calling for the prosecution of George W. Bush and members of the Bush administration. So I'd say, it is, the word is out there. The thing is that none of our corporate media will go near it. They simply will not talk about it. Marty in Delray Beach, Florida. Hey, Marty.
Hey, I chimed in a couple weeks ago. Just want to say, do you think, and I this is the one thing I really just don't understand, is that people, you got to get ready for an October surprise when they freeze out Bin Laden and trot him out and say, John McCain helped us get him.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, I think that's in the bank already. He's probably frozen. He's probably been dead. Because there's no way in the world you would not, after bombing those two buildings, not celebrate the anniversary, even mentioned in this case. Yeah.
Well, he certainly is showing up in a Hillary Clinton campaign commercial this week. Yeah, I'm ready for an October surprise. Tomorrow, Dr. Richard North on Speaking of This, scared to death. And the ambassador to the United States from Finland is going to be with us. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Tag. You're it. We make democracy happen. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.